Welcome to the second in what is to be a series over the coming years, perhaps beyond my lifetime, on the issue that is upon us and that is going to be haunting us for a long time. It's what we have done to the atmosphere. Since the Industrial Revolution, the atmosphere has increased its concentration of carbon dioxide from something like 270 or 280 parts per million to something approaching very closely 400 parts per million, and it's not stopping. And that in itself is a great cause of concern, plus the other so-called greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide. All this is bound to change the climate in ways that are very hard to foresee and very variegated over the globe. And so let's begin by a kind of an overview. What do I touch here, Cynthia? On the mouse. The mouse. The mouse. Good. And it shows Daniel Hillel and Cynthia Rosenzweig. So if the responsibility is shared, Cynthia. Okay. This is a kind of an overview, a textbook overview of the land and atmosphere and water. The water on the land, beneath the land, the water alongside the land, and the exchange of energy and of all of the other materials that are of great interest to us. We've seen this picture many times before, but it always helps to be reminded of the interplay. This is a somewhat more detailed one, but also a textbook example, and we need to ponder it, but we need not specify because it's very familiar. Now here's a schematic view of the three domains. The atmosphere hovering above with its total content of carbon in the form mainly of carbon dioxide and a bit of methane. And there is something like 750 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere, and it's increasing. And the various exchanges with the vegetation on land, the soil itself, the subsoil, and then underneath, deep underneath, is a great store resulting from eons past of fossil fuels, and we have been drawing up these fossil fuels and burning them and spewing out the resulting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And then the exchanges take place in the ocean as well. Carbon dioxide is soluble, and it exchanges in the ocean. And this is a kind of a schematic overview, worth reminding ourselves that we're living in a variegated and dynamic globe. This is what has happened over the last century and a half or so, century and a quarter, to the carbon dioxide concentration. Again, something very familiar, but worth remembering and pondering and doing something about. Now, the background is that the Earth's terrestrial ecosystem is a biodynamic machine driven by solar energy, involving the exchanges of water and carbon and nitrogen and all the other elements. And we have, human beings have taken over this domain, and we don't always know what we're doing and the eventual implications and interactions that we have set in motion. Green plants are what we all depend on. They perform photosynthesis by absorbing atmospheric carbon dioxide, though it's very dilute. A marvel of how they're able to transform it into the production of organic carbon in combination with soil-derived water. And we depend on that vitally. They are autotrophs, we are heterotrophs, in a way, parasites over what green plants can do. So, these are facts well known, but just worth reminding ourselves of it. Now, carbon exchange in the terrestrial domain is such that the soils are the major absorbers, depositories, and transmitters of organic carbon. And they contain roughly 2.5 times as much as the atmosphere, the soils alone. And then there is biota. So altogether you have a store in the terrestrial domain that is 3 times the content of carbon in the atmosphere. Now, this is all spatially and temporally variable depending on the balance of inputs versus outputs over time. Let's go to the next one and get a global view and see how very variegated the soils are. It's a tapestry, and we have to be very careful beyond talking in generalities and begin specifying. And this is the intent of this second symposium in the series. In the first one, we talked in generalities. This time, we're trying to focus regionally. And we hope very much that the resulting publication that Cynthia described is going to bring us closer to understanding specific regional effects and problems, and perhaps solutions as well. This is the soils of the world as classified by the standard classification, the American classification at least. The Europeans take issue with it somewhat. And we focus now on the particular soils that contain sizable amounts of carbon. And notice that in red are the entosols, the gelosols. The gelosols are of special concern because global warming is likely to set in motion a set of positive interactions, positive feedbacks, so that the thawing of permafrost is likely to begin spewing out a tremendous amount of carbon that is now contained in the soil, in the frozen soils of the world. These are the soils we must be concerned about mostly, most of all. And this is a kind of view of the soils. We all know these soils. We've studied them just to remind ourselves of how variegated, how different the different soils of the world are, and particularly their carbon content and the lability of the carbon in the soils. Gelosols, histosols, inceptosols, mollosols. The souls to be saved in both senses. Climate change impacts on different soils. These are generalities. We all know them. Nonetheless, they're worth being reminded of. Soil formation involves the interaction of climate, topography, geology, biota, and time, and they differ from region to region. Consequently, there are numerous soil types that differ in basic properties and potential responses to climate change. So we must go beyond speaking in generalities and begin focusing specifically on the different regions, the different soils of the world. Human management of soils. The soil carbon balance is greatly influenced by human management or mismanagement, including the clearing or the restoration of natural vegetation and the modes of land use. Is there water? The cultivation of soils, of course, spurs microbial decomposition of soil organic matter while depriving it of replenishment, especially if the cropping program involves removal of plant matter and if the soil is kept bare seasonally. And so the mode of land management is very important, and we must concentrate increasingly on methods of land management that preserve and even enhance the organic matter content. Organic matter is lost in the soil not only by decomposition but also by erosion. And some cultivated soils over time lose as much as 1/3 to 2/3 of their carbon content. Now the important point. Though agricultural soils have acted in the past as significant sources of atmospheric carbon dioxide, their present carbon deficits offer us an opportunity to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and to store it as added organic matter in future decades. And we have begun to change the mode of agriculture from clean cultivation as we used to practice to modes of land management that are carbon enriching. And that's a very important change in the mode of land management, which needs to be encouraged and developed. It not only enriches the soil with carbon, it also reduces the amount of carbon that is emitted by the excessive use of machinery that was the standard mode of cultivation in generations past. The historical loss of carbon in the world's agricultural soils is variously estimated to total some 42 to 78 billion tons. Substantial restoration of that loss may be achieved by minimizing soil disturbance while optimizing nutrient and water supply to maximize plant production and residue retention. This is a view all too familiar, all too sad, of mismanagement of soils, all too prevalent around the world. So, reversing the depletion via carbon sequestration is the benign cycle that we want to set in motion. And we'll be talking about this throughout the day and in future months and years. The recommended practices include reforestation, agroforestry, no-till farming to avoid mechanical disturbance of the soil, use of high-residue cover crops, shortening or elimination of the fallow periods, augmentation of soil nutrients by fertilizers, manures, compost, sludge, application of soil amendments such as lime to neutralize acidity, improved grazing, soil and water conservation, and the production of energy crops to replace the fossil fuels that we're now using altogether too wantonly. Now comes a caveat. We shouldn't delude ourselves. Soil and economic conditions differ greatly from one location to another and from one period to another. Therefore, there can be no simple, universal prescription or panacea regarding practices to manage soils, and it is this that we wish to study today. We want to encompass the world in specifics, go beyond generalities. This is what has happened in the past and what we hope to begin and have begun in many places to restore carbon in soils. And in the process, of course, improve soil fertility and productivity. What are the practices to help mitigate global warming? The agricultural sector can help mitigate global warming in three main ways: by reducing its own emissions via adaptation of such practices as no-till planting, absorbing atmospheric carbon dioxide by enhanced photosynthesis, storing carbon in the soil, and producing renewable biofuels from biomass, convertible to ethanol and diesel and so on. Modern precision agriculture can help us. There are necessary caveats. I mentioned some of them before. Some practices aimed at intensifying agricultural production can entail the use of mechanical and chemical energy, which needs to be looked at carefully. We have to do the carbon balance of every action we take. The potential sequestration of organic matter in soils is generally finite. The soils are not infinite absorbers. We can bring them up to what they were, perhaps in the virgin state. Beyond that, we should not delude ourselves that it's an endless sink. Now, all this comes down to economics. We need to emplace economic policies that will promote carbon-efficient practices. Now, we are engaged in a downward spiral. Agroecosystems, through burning of plant cover and cultivating and cutting trees for fuel, and the loss of biodiversity by overgrazing, by denudation, by loss of organic matter and waterlogging, spewing out carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide, by wind erosion of soils, nutrient leaching, sheet and gully erosion, crusting, compaction, and loss of productivity. That is all too prevalent around the world, and it is something that we need to reverse and begin a benign upward cycle. Agroecosystems must be managed efficiently through agroforestry, intercropping, pasture improvement, maintenance of biodiversity, encouragement of biodiversity, conservation tillage, mulching and green manuring, all these good things, organic matter enrichment, drought contingency planning so that during droughts we don't destroy ecosystems that are very hard to recover. Enhancing soil stability, fertility, soil and water conservation, germplasm conservation, and productivity increase, and we rise in this benign cycle upwards to sustainable production. That's the motto. It's the theme of the day. And with that, I rest our case. Cynthia is going to take over and manage the proceedings. Thank you very much for being here and participating. People standing in the back need not stand. There are plenty of seats. Come. Come one, come ye all. Come all ye faithful. I will take a question or two or three.
Yes. We have a few minutes for questions. Let's start the discussion.
I see so many hands. Good. Yes.
Yes.
What is the potential of generating methane? Methane is present in many waterlogged soils, and global warming may cause the methane hydrates and so on, to be emitted from soils such as permafrost soils where they are now contained. So the warming itself may set in motion a positive feedback. It's so-called positive. From our point of view, it is negative. But from the mathematical point of view, it's called a positive feedback. And that many of the tundra soils, the permafrost soils, contain a tremendous reserve of carbon in the form of methane hydrates. And that needs to be watched. Places like Siberia, and the northern tier of Canada and Alaska and so on is what we're referring to. Cynthia, do you want to handle some questions?
I'll just stand there for you. Yes.
Any ideas how to bring economic drivers forward to make this happen as opposed to what's currently happening?
Very good question. And that will be, I think, part of what we will be discussing throughout in some of the talks throughout the day. Economically, probably we're going to have some government subsidies to get the programs going, I think, to set up carbon markets so that then the sequestered carbon can then be traded and there can be putting an economic value on carbon. Right now, that has only primarily happened through voluntary markets. Eventually, to have a carbon market that actually works, it will probably have to be set up governmentally. So there's a linkage between having to have a full market. We probably then need to have beyond voluntary markets.
I'll add to that. At the present time, there's something flawed in the way we operate. There's no penalty for befouling the environment, the so-called commons, the global commons. There's no penalty for spewing out carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's untenable. We cannot continue that way. There has to be a penalty for befouling the environment. There has to be a reward for helping to reverse that, to mitigate. And that is an action for individual governments and societies, and it is also a challenge for the international community because we share the atmosphere. No nation has an exclusive right to its atmosphere. There are no vertical walls separating between nations. The atmosphere mixes itself, as does the ocean, but certainly the atmosphere.
Thank you, Dan. Let's stand over time.